You are listening to RudolfSteinerAudio.com. If you are listening to the podcast of this, it is at RudolfSteiner.podbean.com. Please consider becoming a patron. This is a reading of a collection of lectures by Rudolf Steiner entitled Universal Spirituality and Human Physicality, Bridging the Divide. It is volume number 202 in his collected works. This is lecture 3. Given in Dornach on the 28th of November, 1920. If we look back now at what we described yesterday and the day before, we are in a position to discern a more intimate connection between the human being and the universe surrounding him. We related the human physical body to the whole cosmos in terms of our head organism, rhythmic organism, and metabolic organism. Likewise, we related the human soul and the human mind or spirit to the whole cosmos. Our relationship to the cosmos, which can become apparent in this way, our whole place in the world as human beings, was inevitably seen in a different light in ancient times from how it must be seen now. And it will inevitably increasingly be seen in future as humanity progresses. We have often stated that an instinctive primal wisdom held sway in humanity in ancient times, one human beings did not develop by inner effort, but which, rather, they felt dawn in them in a sort of half-dream. This insight was given them, and they needed to do nothing but open their inner organs of perception to receive what came toward them as a divine gift from the cosmos. Since we are threefold beings, this primeval, instinctive wisdom inevitably saw our whole relationship with the cosmos as a trinity. When people turn their attention more toward what they belonged to before birth, which shone in spiritually during the time between birth and death, and essentially appeared in the wide span of the cosmos, they spoke of beauty, the beauty of the cosmos, a world of beauty out of which they felt they had been born, in relation to their head, their thinking organism, and their wakefulness. This is what a primeval human being felt, that benevolent spiritual beings existed and manifested around him. You see, primeval human beings did not regard natural phenomena in such a dry and sober way as we do today, as long as we dwell only in ordinary awareness. Instead, they saw a spirituality everywhere revealed, and likewise soul quality. This cosmos, unveiled in a primeval person's instinctive consciousness, in mighty dream images, as revelation of spirit and soul, was what he called the beauty of the cosmos. At this time, human beings felt they were, in a sense, standing on their planet. They felt connected with their planet, from which food grew, as a place to stand. They sensed the planet's strength, which penetrated their body, manifested in the soul as will, and strengthened them in the state of sleep. They felt this strength, in turn, to be the gift of benevolent, divine, spiritual beings, and called it strength, or vigor. "The planet fills me with vigor and strength," that was roughly primeval man's experience, though he was unable to clearly formulate it in words. Thus he felt he stood in the midst of what was configured in his head, embodied in images in his thoughts, and illumined in his waking consciousness. And he felt he stood upon the planet in relation to the strength living in his limbs, the strength the planet conveyed to him. He experienced the strength active in the stone when it fell to the ground, creating a hole in the ground with the stone's impact, as living in his legs when he walked. He felt this connected him through his legs with the earth as his vigor, lived in his arms when he worked, permeating the strength of his muscles. Thus he felt himself standing midway between beauty and vigor, and felt it was his task to create a balance through rhythm between the upper world of beauty and the lower world of vigor, regarding this balance as wisdom. Here once again he felt borne up and sustained by spiritual beings, the bearers of wisdom who illumined him with wisdom, in creating this balance between beauty and vigor. Thus human beings experienced what they received from the cosmos in terms of beauty, wisdom, and vigor. Mystery teachings, whose light shone far afield, gave people the sense of being connected with the whole universe by beauty, wisdom, and vigor, of being permeated with strength by these qualities. You can say that the outer world surrounding them, the inner nature within them, and the balance of these two was felt by them, respectively as beauty, vigor, and wisdom. The diverse secret societies retained an ongoing experience of these three qualities, though we can sometimes discern very clearly that only the words were preserved, without any deeper understanding. You see, a time arose for humanity when this sense of things, this instinctive knowledge of our connection with the cosmos, albeit only instinctive, was pushed down into the dark, below the level of awareness. Human beings came to live, in a sense, in subordinate ideas, in subordinate feelings. They drew their will impulses from subordinate elements of their own being. They forgot what they had once experienced as beauty, wisdom, and vigor, and this was necessary in the pursuit of human freedom. From a kind of inner chaos in the human being, a central power had to emerge, without access any longer to light and strength-imbued qualities originally revealed to primeval man. Yet modern humanity will not progress unless it allows to arise again from within what was once revealed by the universe as beauty, wisdom, and vigor. The cosmos will not outwardly reveal itself in beauty to us on earth again while we remain earthly humankind. Those times, an era of primordial, instinctive wisdom, have passed. They were times when human beings could not become free, but could only develop in unfreedom, driven by instincts. These times will not come again. Instead, we must allow to arise from within us, be resurrected, what we once received from without as wisdom, beauty, and vigor. The power of beauty that was absorbed, or, if you like, imbibed from the universe, was incorporated into us during ancient primordial lives on earth. It lives in lives that followed this era, a middle period which we passed through in Egyptian, Greek, and modern times. This was likewise absorbed, but did not surface in human awareness. Now humanity has reached a stage of maturity where it can draw this again from its awareness, and is doing so. The power of beauty that was imbibed will resurface from within, and the science of the spirit offers guidance on how this should happen. It will arise from within through the faculty of imagination. You see, everything that is conveyed through imagination in spiritual science is nothing other than the resurrected life of beauty as it existed within primordial wisdom. And all that a person once experienced when he sensed the power of his planet, which also encompassed the whole power of the cosmos, albeit centered as it was then and still is in the planet, must arise again through us grasping it from within, through the faculty of intuition. From our present time onward, beauty imbibed from the universe becomes imagination for humanity, while vigor becomes intuition when grasped through free, independent human powers, and wisdom becomes inspiration. We left behind us an age when we received beauty, wisdom, and vigor from without. These words, wisdom, beauty, vigor, have become empty rote, really, in certain secret societies, amongst the Freemasons and such like, and are cultivated with no inner understanding. With real inner understanding, one would know that these words refer to ancient traditions that must live again as imagination, inspiration, and intuition. It is therefore a rather secondary kind of wisdom for members of this or that order to come along and discern a similarity between things said in spiritual science and the tradition such orders retain, which they mostly fail to understand. In spiritual science, the meaning and context of these words is drawn from actual spirit knowledge. Thus, human beings left behind a primordial era when the mysteries of the universe were revealed to them in beauty, wisdom, and vigor. They must walk forward toward a new era when the mysteries of the universe are revealed to them by the imagination, inspiration, and intuition of those who seek or should seek these powers of knowledge, and can do so by some means. Yet what can be drawn from inspiration, intuition, and imagination can already be understood by anyone who wants to understand them. This primordial age, though, was susceptible to a certain danger, which arose most strongly in the civilized world of those days, throughout Egypt, the Near East, India, and so forth, toward the end of the second millennium B.C. The danger was this, that people did not receive in the right way, in instinctive cognition, what was revealed to them, as it were, by grace from the universe. Let me describe how one might succumb to this danger. You have to form a vivid idea of what it meant when nature was revealed to people in its grandeur and beauty, not as it appears today in our prosaic minds, but as majestic pictorial revelations of spiritual beings, as something that appeared from every spring or cloud. Especially at this period, toward the end of the second millennium B.C., things were different from how they had been previously, when they were somehow more self-evident. At this later period, human beings had to earn this grace of vision by doing something to receive it. They did not yet have to do this in full conscious awareness, as we must now seek higher spiritual development, but they could, and this capacity was really very dubious, develop a lust for this spiritual quality manifesting in nature, could ignite the potencies of their needs and drives. Then they could perceive the spirit arising, as it were, from nature, and in this igniting of drives and needs lay a strongly luciferic endowment. Most of you know, of course, how natural it was for elemental beings to appear to people in ancient Atlantean times. They continued to manifest in the clairvoyance of post-Atlantean times, but this faculty gradually faded, and in awareness of this, people were still able to conjure such visions from natural phenomena through the potency of their needs. The danger they encountered in doing so was luciferic in nature. People could, in a sense, still jolt themselves, arouse themselves to unite with spiritual qualities. But this kind of jolting introduced the luciferic element into them, and the civilized world of those times, toward the end of the second millennium B.C., was therefore strongly contaminated by a luciferic quality. On other occasions, we have spoken of this luciferic contamination from different perspectives and traced it back to other causes. But now I'd like to consider it from the point of view so far adopted in these three lectures. This luciferic contamination of the world in those days contrasts with another kind, an Ahrimanic contamination, which is currently gaining ground and doing so with hugely powerful strength. It is really very dreadful to see how modern civilized people are asleep in regard to what is happening. Consider how mechanical powers, powers of the machine, have recently been growing. I have spoken of this before from other angles. It is not long ago at all that people had to use their muscles to do what they can now, to some extent, leave to machines they just type upon. What happens in these machines relies upon forces which human beings draw from the earth by mining coal. Coal supplies the energy that makes our machines function. When we get a machine to work alongside us, we cede to the machine something we ourselves used to have to do. Now the machine does it. Beside us stands the machine and performs the work that we used to do ourselves. The machine's capacity is measured in horsepower. Larger measurements calculate what is accomplished as energy output in terms of a horse's daily work over 1 year. Now, think of the following. In 1870, as we can discover from coal mining statistics, and I have intentionally chosen this war year, 6,700,000 horsepower years of work were done in Germany. In other words, quite apart from the work done by people, machines themselves produced an output equal to 6,700,000 horsepower years. By 1912, again in Germany, machines accomplished 79 million horsepower years of work. Since Germany has almost 79 million inhabitants, therefore, you can say that one horse works alongside every single person the whole year through. And now, consider the increase this represents from 6.7 million horsepower years within only a few decades. And now, consider this in the context of the dire outbreak of war. The same year, 1912, when the combined output of machines in France, Russia, and Belgium produced 35 million horsepower years of work, Great Britain was responsible for 98 million horsepower years. The War of 1870 was largely waged by people, since mechanical resources were not easily mobilized then. In Germany, only 6.7 million horsepower years were available. In only a few decades, things changed radically. This later war, as you know, was really a confrontation of machines. At the front, machines waged war, employing machines' horsepower years of work to do so. In fact, Great Britain only slowly and gradually mobilized its 98 million horsepower years. But then, as the combined force of the mechanical resources of these countries, 133 million horsepower years stood face to face with Germany's 79 million horsepower years, or if you include Austria, roughly 92 million horsepower years. As I said, things were not initially so uneven, since Great Britain was not able to mobilize its horsepower years so rapidly and convert this power from agricultural work to warfare. In this terrible catastrophe of war, the opposing sides were no longer governed by the wisdom of generals, even if these did dictate certain trends, so much as by mechanical forces that bombarded one another at the front, which were far less dependent on the generals than on previous scientific inventions by human beings. What fate followed inevitably from this? Let us assume that the 139 million horsepower years of the United States are also included here. So you see that irrespective of the brilliance of generals, the mechanical powers humankind produced within only a few decades would predetermine the fate of the world. There was nothing to be done about this fate, no way of combating this inevitability where the outcome was dictated by mechanical forces bombarding one another. So what do we have here? Human beings have employed their thinking to construct machines. By doing so, they have implanted in these machines the powers of reason gained through science. In a sense, therefore, man's power of reason got carried away, escaped from his head, and turned into horsepower years in his physical surroundings. And these horsepower years, having made their escape, now work on autonomously. In the civilized world, people are largely fast asleep to these things, with little idea of the dizzy speed at which human beings have in recent decades created a non-human world beyond human control. In the era I described at the end of the second millennium BC, a human being was surrounded by luciferic contaminations. Spirit beings appeared in nature, outside him, in response to the potency of his needs. If we imagine this to be a natural object, and there's a drawing, plate 6, the spirit being appeared within it. Now, by contrast, the human being lets his mind and spirit flow into matter, into machines. Here we find that in Germany, for example, every person has created a horse beside him by his powers of reason. We find that this horse works alongside him, and is not a horse at all, but a mechanical force. It is a force sundered from the human being. Just as these elemental beings were once, though in a different sense, sundered from the human being. Then they were sundered by people applying their luciferic power to them. Now people apply their Ahrimanic power similarly, in an Ahrimanizing, mechanizing direction. We live in the age of Ahrimanic contamination. People do not notice that they are actually withdrawing from the world, incorporating their reason into the world, and thus creating an increasingly autonomous world alongside them. This great diabolical experiment, as I will call it, has been at work since 1914, triggered really by one Ahrimanic entity against another. This Ahrimanic battle encompassed almost the whole globe, assuming its Ahrimanic character because the human being created a new Ahrimanic world in the machines that now surround him. And this is a new Ahrimanic world. If you study the figures, an increase in non-human mechanical power from 6.7 million to 79 million horsepower years in just a few decades, with similar increases in other countries, you can see the rapid growth of Ahriman. Given this, is it not legitimate to ask whether we are in the process of losing all grip on what falls within the domain of our will, our autonomous initiative? Is it right for human beings increasingly to fall prey to the illusion that they themselves undertake things, whereas in reality, Ahrimanic powers, calculated in horsepower years, are working against each other? For someone who has a clear view of the world, Foch, Ludendorff, and Haig are interesting only in their moral dimension. As far as reality itself is concerned, the forces derived from coal that bombard one another at the front are of true interest. Led there from mechanical workshops and developed by human invention in previous years, these turn what happens into a matter of mere arithmetical computation. Growing increasingly Ahrimanic, the world and its events become a matter of simple arithmetic. And what is the position of the human being in all this? He stands like a dullard beside his machines, which end up subverting his existence as he discovers still more complex combinations of forces. This Ahrimanization is our modern counterpart to the Luciferization of the world I spoke of earlier. We need to be aware of this. For is it not perhaps the most tangible way of demonstrating the need for us to create out of our own inner resources? We will not prevent this progressive Ahrimanization, nor should we, for to do so would be to regard every mechanical advance as the Nuremberg Medical Association did in 1839, or the postmaster of Berlin before the railway was built. He said it was ridiculous for the people in Berlin to send a train to Potsdam every week, since he already sent two post coaches to Potsdam each week, and they were always empty. We cannot halt the advance of mechanization, for culture has to take its course. Culture demands Ahrimanization. But what works from within us can be set against it. All that once again draws wisdom, beauty, and strength, thus vigor from the human soul, in imagination, inspiration, and intuition. You see, the worlds that dawn there will be the worlds of the human being. They will stand before us in the spirit, in the soul, while, outside us, the mechanical forces of Ahriman unfold. And these powers that rise up from imagination, inspiration, and intuition will be capable of managing and directing what surrounds us with its dizzy speed of Ahrimanization that will otherwise inevitably overpower us. What comes from the world of spirit, from imagination, inspiration, and intuition, is stronger than all horsepower years that the mechanization of the world can ever produce. Yet the mechanizing powers would overwhelm us if we did not find the counterbalance by seeking what the world of spirit can reveal to us. What comes to the fore in spiritual science and seeks knowledge in imagination, inspiration, and intuition is not some kind of invention, but a necessity that we can find tangibly implicit in the course of human evolution. One has to state that the human being would be overpowered by the extra-human potencies he himself has created as computable horsepower in an Ahrimanized world. At the time when humankind received what wisdom, beauty, and vigor brought him from without, he did not yet have an Ahrimanized world around him, and so he could absorb these qualities by or through grace. He had only the simplest tools at that era, and had mastered fire, and these things did not add very much to his own strength. Only since roughly the second half of the 19th century have we had a quite new world, which I would describe as a vast new geological stratum covering the earth. To the geological strata of diluvium, alluvium, and so forth, has been added an Ahrimanic stratum, forming something like a crust over the globe. From the depths there surfaces something which overpowers humankind. If, when we place ourselves into the outer world, we do not bring with us the world vouchsafed us from the spirit, that is, from imagination, intuition, and inspiration. When we properly understand the course of evolution, we discover mighty impulses directing us to the need for a culture and civilization founded on the science of the spirit. Such a need can itself be calculated. Is it not terrible, after all, that this extra geological layer is spreading with such dizzy speed like a new earth crust over the globe, although many people still think in the way they did when the sum of mechanized horsepower years in Germany was only 6.7 million? Do people give any thought at all to what is powering the world's development? Are they aware of what is really happening? No. For otherwise insight into what is happening would show them the need to find new ways for humankind to imbue itself with what was called beauty, wisdom, and vigor in olden times, and which, in seeking to realize the necessary further development of the human entelechy, we must call imagination, inspiration, and intuition. Currently, therefore, we are looking into a world of Ahrimanic contamination. I have often said in the past that I am hesitant about using the phrase, quote, time of transition, close quote, too easily, for every age is really one of transition. Yet an age such as we live in, with such distinctive and rapid Ahrimanization, as we have seen since the latter third of the 19th century, does not occur so frequently. And the bourgeois period that preceded it throughout much of Central Europe really cannot be compared with what has in reality been happening in recent decades. We have to be fully aware of the gravity of these new developments. We must have a true sense of them, and of the following also. If we consider an event such as the war in Europe during 1870-71, you will see that it was still possible to survey what happened, to trace its development. But now, look at how people still try to think in this same way about events of recent years. They are still thinking in the way people did at a time when only 6.7 million horsepower years were available in Germany. People simply do not grasp the fact that they need to think differently when 79 million horsepower years are at work outside the human being. This requires us to make space for a quite different kind of thinking. Without turning to spiritual science, the riddles of current events cannot be solved. If human beings mechanize the world around them through external empirical science, then it is all the more essential that they allow an inner science, a new form of wisdom, to arise within them. And this will be capable of governing and directing what would otherwise overwhelm them. The end of Lecture 3.